This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
1970, across the country, student protest escalated into campus violence. One small group turned to bank robbery and murder to finance their vision of the revolution.
In March of 1950, in the town of Beatrice, Nebraska, an explosion blew apart a small church. 12 devoted choir members were spared from certain death by an amazing chain of events which today remain an unsolved mystery. On a lonely back road in Tennessee, three men out for a joyride drove straight into a nightmare. They were blown apart by multiple shotgun blasts. We'll also bring you the intriguing story of a 20-year-old girl who's plagued by a series of bizarre and troubling dreams that some believe foretold her ultimate fate. 1 year later, Cindy Anderson disappeared. She has never been seen again. In 1980, 20-year-old Cindy Anderson was plagued by a series of vivid dreams. In one episode, Cindy recognized the man at the door and let him in. Then in the nightmare, her trust was betrayed. Cindy became increasingly tormented by these bizarre dreams.
One morning while I was getting ready for work, I overheard Cindy talking to my mother.
What's wrong?
Mommy had a dream last night.
Well, tell me about it.
There was this man, and I kept trying to get away, and he kept chasing me and coming after me.
Cindy, it was only a dream.
No, Mom, but he murdered me.
Cindy, I do believe that the dreams could have been a premonition of fears that Cindy actually had in her subconscious at the time.
The nightmares lasted for a year. Then on August 4th, 1981, Cindy Anderson went to work as usual. She was employed as a legal secretary, and in the mornings usually manned the office alone. She kept the door locked at all times. A buzzer had even been installed at her desk so that if trouble did arise, she could alert the shop next door. At noon, Jim Rabbit and Jay Feldstein, two of the lawyers, arrived back at their office.
Jay and I came back from downtown, went up to the door, and the lights were on, the door was locked. We unlocked the door, went inside, yelled for Cindy, and there was no answer.
Look at the sign, Mr. Hey, Cindy!
I started to look around out front. Cindy, when she would leave, would place the phones on hold, and that wasn't done either.
Hey, Jim.
Andrew.
Come back here and take a look at this. Take a look at this for a second. Look what that page was turned to.
The
lawyers discovered that Cindy had left her romance novel open at the only violent scene in the entire book. Where the heroine is abducted at knife point.
Perhaps we should call somebody?
It wasn't until really looking at the book, particularly reading the passage in the novel, I just had a sickening feeling that something was wrong.
Cindy was never heard from or seen again. There was no body, no farewell letter, no hint where she had gone or why. Were Cindy's dreams premonitions of a terrible fate, or were they just coincidences?
For 8 years, this extraordinary case has baffled the police and Cindy's friends and family. Was this young girl abducted and murdered? Could Cindy be alive somewhere, suffering from amnesia? Or did she simply run away to start a new life? Cindy Anderson was raised in a strict religious environment. Her family, her boyfriend, and most of her inner social circle were all devout Christian fundamentalists.
She was a very quiet, obedient type of a girl. She never made waves with either myself or her mother. And she had lots of friends. She was the type of daughter that you just enjoy. I mean, the type of daughter that, you know, just a beautiful young girl.
At the time of Cindy's disappearance, there were no circumstances in her life that any of us were aware of that would have caused her to have run away. She was looking forward to quitting her job in 2 weeks and going to a Bible college where she would attend with her boyfriend. She was very excited about it.
Just before she disappeared, however, she was becoming like a debutante. She was spending a lot of time on her face and herself, and she had skipped breakfast for this reason. She spent more time on herself than she did on her stomach, and that may be part of the reason of part of the problem.
Keith, here's some lady friends.
The day Cindy vanished, the police immediately began a search for clues. They could not find Cindy's car keys and purse. The office was undisturbed. There were no signs of a struggle.
Her purse or something.
Her car was parked in front of the law office. Her bank account, which had a nice substantial amount of money, was never touched. Her Social Security number has never shown up under any other workplace. It's a complete mystery how and why Cindy disappeared.
10 months earlier, Cindy noticed an odd coincidence. On the parking lot wall across from her office, someone had painted the words, "I Love You, Cindy," by G.W.
There are lots of Cindys in the world, but I think from the very beginning she wondered. It was so largely printed and so visible to her, it was just very eerie, and it was the only graffiti on the wall.
There was no other woman named Cindy working in that side of the strip mall that it could have been for, so it was strategically placed, and it really gave us the heebie-jeebies.
The spray-painted sign was visible for about 6 months, then it was covered up. Within weeks, the same message reappeared. This time, it was even larger.
Cindy tried to figure out who D.W. could have been, and we couldn't think of anyone at school, at church, in our group of friends, at home, in the neighborhood, so it did bother us a lot.
We attempted to locate people that Cindy would know with those initials. Among the people that were investigated with the initials G.W. was the maintenance man who had worked for the law firm for some time. He had keys to both doors. In fact, he had keys to all the offices.
The police did not find any evidence that the maintenance man wrote the graffiti and are still puzzled by the message.
The day before Cynthia Anderson disappeared, I had been in the law offices to pay off a legal fee. She got a phone call.
Law offices.
She kind of reacted like maybe it was obscene or something,
because
she hung up real quick.
Okay. $30.
Okay.
And she got another phone call, and the look on her face still, I can picture it today. She was scared. She was honestly, sincerely scared. It gives me shivers to think of the look on her face. Some kind of problem?
No, it's just been happening lately.
You sure?
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, well, here you go.
Okay.
I'll call him later to see how things are going.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I went home and I called the police department and asked them to do a drive-by and check on her. Something scared the hell out of her, in my opinion.
In September 1981, a month after Cindy vanished, another strange phone call gave police their first concrete lead.
Detective Adams.
Colliery Gardens.
on the Cynthia Anderson case.
Who is this?
No, I can't give you my name.
She said that she was scared,
and
she was talking in low whispers.
All I know is I was told she was being held in a basement of a White House.
Can't you give me the address?
No,
she
I can't.
She kept saying
stay with
that
me a little
she
while.
Had to go. I kept begging
ma'am,
her to stay on the line,
me
give me more information, give me an exact address,
can you give me
something that
name?
We could act on.
I've got to go.
A short while later, she again called.
Detective Adams.
Calling again about the Cynthia Anderson case.
I'm glad you called back, ma'am.
Adams signaled Sergeant Mihailov to pick up the extension. But as soon as he came on the line, the woman abruptly hung up again.
She's called twice now, and she hangs up.
The lady mentioned that there were two houses side by side, owned by the same family, and that the family was out of town. But their son was home, and he was the party that was holding Cindy in the basement. We did check street after street in the north end to see if we could find two houses side by side. There's so many that you can't get a positive location for the house. If she is watching, I would like her to call us again. I appeal to her to call for any further information that she might have.
My hope is that my daughter is alive and well and living a normal life, perhaps with loss of memory. If she herself is out there, we want her to know that we love her, and we certainly want her to come back, whatever the case may be. The door is open. We certainly want anybody and everybody that can possibly help in this situation to do so.
Cynthia Anderson has been missing from the Toledo, Ohio area since August of 1981. If she is still alive, she would be 28 years old today. These composites show what she might look like now. She's 5'4" tall, with brown hair and brown eyes. Some of our viewers continue to help authorities track down wanted fugitives. Recently, your tips led to the arrest of an escaped felon wanted by the Illinois State Police. In November, we featured a story about a family of fortune tellers who have allegedly conned their clients out of millions of dollars. 53-year-old Lena Marie Wilson, her 26-year-old daughter Ann Coricelli, and their accomplice, 39-year-old Joe Marks, were all wanted by authorities on charges stemming from a fortune-telling scheme operated by Wilson and Coricelli in Peoria, Illinois. Update, Joe Marks has been captured. Within minutes of our broadcast, the Springfield, Missouri Police Department received a call from a viewer who recognized Joe Marks. On November 20th, Greene County, Missouri Sheriff's deputies arrested Marks at his parents' home, where his mother was operating a palm reading business. February 22, 1950, the West End Baptist Church, Beatrice, Nebraska. Between the years of 1920 and 1950, choir director Martha Paul ruled the roost every Wednesday night. She demanded punctuality. If you wanted to sing in her choir, you showed up no later than 7:25 p.m. All the members of Martha's choir towed the line.
On Wednesday evening, Mother expected all of us to be punctual. No one was ever really late. There might have been very, very few circumstances, but most often everyone was there all the time. I really can't think of a time that anyone came late.
Hallelujah. Very nice. place. See you Sunday and next week at 7:15.
Though no one knew it, that night would be the last choir rehearsal in the West End Church. 1 week later, the members of the choir became part of a baffling, unsolved mystery. Some call it a strange coincidence, but others believe it was something more. On March 1st, at exactly 7:27 p.m., tragedy struck the West End Baptist Church. But despite years of unfailing punctuality, this Wednesday night was different. The afternoon of March 1st turned bitter cold. The church's pastor, Reverend Walter Klempel, stopped by the church at 4:30 to light the furnace so the church would be warm in time for that evening's choir practice. Reverend Klempel and his wife always brought their 18-month-old daughter with them to choir practice. But that night, the baby stained her dress, and Mrs. Klempel had to iron another one. It was 7:15, and they were running late. At the same time, Martha Paul's teenage daughter, Marilyn, was sound asleep.
It's time to wake up.
Marilyn was the choir's accompanist.
We've got time. There's lots of time. She's had a tough day.
I know.
I was very tired, and I wanted to rest for a very short period of time before going to the church to practice. So I decided that maybe a little 15-minute nap wouldn't hurt, and it ended up being a little bit longer, probably about a half an hour.
A few blocks away, Herbert Kipf, who sang bass in the choir, was preoccupied working on church business.
I know, I just need to finish this by tonight.
Okay.
That night I was writing a letter to our denomination headquarters, and it seemed very important for me to get it into the mail that evening. Fact of the matter is, my mother was hounding me to get going because the time was late already. But I felt it was more important to get it in the mail and drop it on the way to church.
Well, what happened then?
18-year-old Lucille Jones, who sang Alto, let herself get hooked on a radio program that night.
Anyone we know?
I turned on the radio to listen to This Is Your Life. So I just sat down and listened, and I thought, well, I'd have time to make it up there on time. I don't know why I turned it on that night, but I turned it on. They said this was going to be Edgar Bergen's Life, and I just decided I was going to listen to it.
Lucille was also responsible for picking up another choir member, but tonight she didn't care. Edgar Bergen was worth being late for. At 7:23, LaDonna Vandegrift, a 15-year-old soprano in the choir, was struggling with a geometry equation. She was determined to find a solution before she left for rehearsal, but the problem was difficult, and LaDonna was running late. 2 miles away, Marina Estes couldn't get her car started. She, too, was supposed to pick up another choir member, so they were both late. Joyce Black, who lived across the street from the church, was ready for choir practice, but just couldn't seem to get moving.
I was late because I was just plain lazy, and I just didn't want to get out in the cold. And so I kept putting off going out the door. At last, I couldn't put it off any longer, so I put my coat on it. And when I opened up the door and stepped out, our church just disintegrated.
All over town, the lights went out.
Uh-oh.
Was our sheet music and our songbooks. Flying through the air, we had a lot of those things. It was really something to see. A real nice choir book fell right near me, and it was in pretty good condition. So I picked it up. I didn't think anybody'd care, because I wanted to keep it.
Minutes after the explosion, the choir members began to arrive, each one thinking that the others had perished. Frantically, choir members searched the rubble for survivors.
No, are you all here? Is it just on your own?
One by one, all of them straggled in, each fortuitously late for his or her own reason.
When we found out that everyone was safe and that no one was in the explosion, we were standing there holding each other's hands, and one of the members said, "Let's give thanks to God," and we offered a prayer of thanksgiving that we were indeed spared and that no one lost their life. in this explosion.
Thank you for keeping us all together.
If this had been a busload of people stopped by a flat tire or any such occurrence, it might be considered a coincidence. But where you have 10, 12, 15 people scattered throughout the entire city, and each of them detained by some trivial little thing, each different thing, it can't be.
When I realized what had happened, I thought, well, if I wouldn't have been listening to This Is Your Life, my life would have been over.
I believe that night, and no one will convince me otherwise, that God didn't want us there. We were spared. And I'm very grateful.
It turned out that the explosion was caused by a gas leak from an underground pipeline. Today, residents of Beatrice, Nebraska still wonder about the unexplained events that kept each and every choir member safely away from the church. To some, it was simply a remarkable coincidence. But others believe it was the careful design of a greater power. September 23rd, 1970. Three criminals robbed a State Street Bank in Brighton, Massachusetts at gunpoint. Two other gang members waited outside in cars. A well-organized heist netted over $26,000. As police arrived at the scene, a Boston patrolman was shot. The next day, he died. The search for the thieves now became a murder investigation. What was unusual about this professionally staged crime was that two of the felons were Kathy Power and Susan Sachs, college students at prestigious Brandeis University. Kathy Power, the driver of the getaway car, is still wanted by the FBI for murder. Kathy Power's involvement with robbery was symptomatic of the troubled and turbulent 1960s, when radical students erupted in a rash of violent demonstrations. Her commitment to the politics of protest eventually thrust her into a world of mayhem and murder. Two decades. The drawn-out conflict in Vietnam triggered a stronger political awareness throughout America. As the government was pushed unwillingly towards an end to the war, demonstrations and sit-ins fueled the fires of social change. Kathy Power entered college in 1967. The mood became increasingly confrontational. Some peaceful demonstrations became bloody riots. Student activists became zealous radicals. Splinter groups emerged whose avowed aim was to overthrow the government. To finance their revolution, they turned to crime.
There was a loose but effective network of underground groups that were responsible for numerous robberies, numerous thefts of weapons, and funneling this money and materiel through an underground system to some of the more radical, more violent groups that existed in those days.
Show where you at!
The groups that were the most violent were the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground Group, and groups of that type. The group that Catherine Powers, Susan Sachs belonged to didn't carry any particular name, but nonetheless was very violent and involved in numerous violent activities.
By 1970, Catherine Ann Power was a 21-year-old college senior who became swept up in the maelstrom of radical underground politics. A straight-A student named Outstanding Teenager of Colorado, Kathy won a full scholarship to exclusive Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Kathy majored in sociology and made the dean's list every year. But like many students, Kathy wanted to change the world.
I think police are going nuts now. They're going nuts.
Yeah, we need to send down some muscle. There, and she can handle it. She's
Kathy was an active member of the National Strike Information Center, a clearinghouse for student protest across the country.
Listen, how many people are you expecting again? How many of those do you think have been at demonstrations before?
Now, Malcolm's in Alabama. We gotta get Malcolm out of Alabama.
Susan Sachs and Stanley Bond were also closely involved with the center and Kathy's close friends. Susan Sachs was an honor student from Philadelphia. Stanley Bond was a convicted felon who was studying at Brandeis as part of an innovative parole program designed to rehabilitate convicts at nearby Walpole Prison.
Stanley Bond was a criminal, but with revolutionary ideas, if I can use that expression. He was very strong in his beliefs. He has said publicly, you know, if he was in the commission of a crime, he would kill a policeman and consider it an act of war rather than a crime. He would justify that, and he would justify whatever he did in his revolutionary tactics.
Even here in the United States, great universities are being systematically destroyed.
April of 1970 saw a new wave of protest as President Nixon expanded the war into Cambodia. At Kent State University, four students were shot to death by Ohio National Guardsmen.
This was the scene yesterday at Kent State University as demonstrators and National Guardsmen squared off for the second straight day. Monday's confrontation escalated to a tragic conclusion. Just after noon, the guardsmen opened fire after rocks were allegedly thrown at them. 13 seconds later, four students were dead and nine were wounded. The dead students have been identified as Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Schuer, and William Schroeder.
This is revolution. This is really revolution.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth.
Kathy, Susan, and Stanley Bond felt strongly that violence was a proper means to their end. In 3 months, the group robbed over a dozen banks to fund the revolution. Stanley Bond recruited two fellow convicts, also on the parole program. Robert Valeri, a convicted armed robber, and William Lefty Gilday, a convicted bank robber.
The group was notorious. Aside from the State Street robbery, they committed numerous other crimes, up to maybe 17 others, several of which we did identify either one or more members of the group of five.
On September 20th, 1970, the group stole explosives and automatic weapons from a Massachusetts armory. After the heist, they firebombed the building. 3 days later, the radical gang prepared to rob the State Street Bank in Brighton, Massachusetts.
Kathy Power got mixed up in a movement that absolutely got out of hand, a revolutionary movement.
Let's go.
There was room for protest in this country. Kathy Power and others took that protest to the point of violence. So I have no sympathy for her activities. I have sympathy for her views in some ways. I can't understand how she got swept as far as she did. But I also have a lot more sympathy for the family of the slain police officer.
I can certainly understand people wanting to make changes in our society. There are a lot of inequities. A lot of people are disadvantaged. And I believe very strongly in trying to give some power to disadvantaged people. But I don't think the way that you do that is to go about killing somebody. Nothing is worth human life. Nothing replaces human life. No amount of money that you could steal from a bank or anything else.
September 23rd, 1970, started normally for Boston Police Patrolman Walter Schroeder and his partner Frank Callahan. Within 24 hours, Schroeder would be dead. Ironically, just 2 years earlier, Officer Schroeder had received a special commendation for foiling another robbery at the State Street Bank.
I don't think we'd get a better partner than Walter because I could depend on him.
I saw your daughter Claire the other day. How's she doing?
I never had to worry about my back when Walter would be. Nothing seemed to scare him. Nothing fazed him at all. Especially if someone was in trouble, he'd go all out to see if he could help them, regardless of what the situation was. I never saw him back down from any incident.
At 9 a.m., as Schroeder and Callahan were patrolling, the gang left their hideout. Bond, Valerie, and Susan Sachs planned to go into the bank itself. Lefty Gilday was assigned to watch the bank entrance from across the street. Kathy Power was waiting a few blocks away in the switch car. At approximately 9:20 a.m., Bond, Valerie, and Sachs pulled up to the bank. Sachs entered the bank through a side door, and her comrades went through the front door.
Everybody, there's a holdup! Money in the bank!
Bond ordered the tellers to place all their available cash into money bags. One teller pressed the silent alarm, and the authorities were alerted.
Car 14-4, we have a silent alarm at the State Street Bank. Please respond. Car 14-4, please respond.
Frank, we're only a couple blocks away. Why don't we back that 14-4 car up?
14-3, we'll back up that unit at the State Street Bank.
I got a strange feeling about this one might be for real. Better hurry up and get up there.
Robbers ran out of the bank. The well-planned heist started to unravel. Gilday began firing indiscriminately.
When we arrived at the bank, I heard six or eight shots, but didn't know where they were coming from. Evidently, Walter didn't realize where they were coming from because he ran right toward this man. And he finally realized where they were coming from, and he tried to turn around and run get around the corner of the bank, but he didn't quite make it. I realized Walter was hurt when I saw him fall. I was hoping that he had just tripped, but deep down I knew that he was hit.
A Boston policeman remains in critical condition tonight following a shootout at the State Street Bank in Brighton. Patrolman Walter Schroeder, a 19-year veteran of the force, shot once in the back as three gunmen left the bank.
Not bad for a day's work, huh?
A day's work? Schroeder and Officer Frank Kelly. Why don't you go and pick off the cop, man?
What's your problem?
I think we deserve a little extra.
The robbery had netted $26,000 in cash. Stanley Bond distributed $500 in spending money to each member of the gang and held on to the remainder himself.
Let's get out of here.
Within 8 hours, the five robbers had all gone their separate ways. And Officer Schroeder lay in St. Elizabeth's Hospital fighting for his life. His partner kept a silent vigil through the night.
Walter's injury was very serious. The ordinary person wouldn't last 5 minutes. He was shot in the back through the aorta, the main artery to the heart. I guess Walter died around 10 o'clock in the morning, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, I was real close with Walter. He was a real friend. He was like one of the family. And I'll never get over it, really. I haven't gotten over it yet.
The effect of his death was devastating. As time has passed, we've learned to adjust to it. But I think that it's created a void that has never been filled and really can't be filled. You know, it's scary when anybody gets killed. It's particularly scary when the people who are charged with the responsibility of taking care of the rest of us are killed.
Within 24 hours, the Boston Police Department had picked up the trail of one of the fleeing killers.
A source on the street gave us the name of Robert Valeri as being one of the people involved in the bank robbery. Boston police arrested Valeri. He was interrogated for quite a few hours. He finally gave the names of all the people. He named William Gilday, named Stanley Bond, named Catherine Powers and Susan Sachs, all being involved in the bank robbery.
5 days later, Stanley Bond was arrested in Grand Junction, Colorado. The next day, Gilday was picked up in Worcester, Massachusetts after a high-speed chase. William Gilday is still serving two life sentences for his part in the crime. Valeri spent 5 years in jail and is now out on parole. Before Stanley Bond's murder trial began, he accidentally killed himself with a homemade bomb he had built for an escape attempt. 5 years later, Susan Sachs was arrested on a Philadelphia street. She spent 7 years in prison and was released in 1982. In 1974, a bank surveillance camera photographed Kathy Power opening a bank account in Louisville, Kentucky. This was the last reported sighting of Kathy Power. Kathy Power has been on the run for almost 19 years, living the life of a fugitive, and has used the following different aliases: Priscilla Coe, Claire Johnson, May Kelly, and Jane Pascarella.
The search for Kathy Powell will continue until she is found, but we have to be realistic. The times have changed. I think the government and the country has come back more to a center space. That would have to have some influence upon what would happen to Kathy Powell. The crime occurred 18 years ago. And I think if Kathy were to turn herself in or to be apprehended, she could be tried, she would be found guilty, but I think a lot of things would have to be taken into consideration at the time of her sentencing.
There's no satisfaction to be derived by me or my family. What's done is done. You can't bring somebody back. But I think it's important because there's a larger message contained in all of it that, we all function as a single unit, as a society, and that there are lines of behavior that are acceptable and there are lines, once you step over that line, it's not acceptable. Her behavior, as with the other people involved, is unacceptable. And you have to be called to task on that. You have to take responsibility for what you do. And if the individual doesn't choose to do it, society, for the protection of everybody else, has to be willing to do it, whether it's something that happened yesterday, last year, or 20 years ago.
Turn the story of the brutal shotgun slaying of three men on a rural Tennessee back road. By last count, 20,000 murders are committed each year in the United States. 30% of these remain unsolved. In many of these cases, a killer is known to the police, but they are powerless without the testimony of key witnesses. In our next story, the police have received anonymous calls from people who claim to know the identity of the killer, but they will not testify until a suspect is safely behind bars. The reason is simple: fear. Signal Mountain, near Chattanooga, Tennessee. On the evening of July the 9th, 1988, Airman First Class Kenneth Griffith, Sergeant Earl Smock, and Griffith's father-in-law, Richard Mason, warmed up their engines before taking off for a few hours of three-wheel riding.
Kenneth and Earl and Richard, all three, were anxious to go, and they got on their motors and revved them up, and they couldn't wait to get out, you know. They were ready to go because they knew they had a few hours of daylight time.
At 6 p.m., the three men left Mason's home on their ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, to
explore the trails in the neighboring woods. By the next morning, they had not returned.
When I woke up, I realized that they weren't home. And I stood at the back door looking for the sun to come up because my feeling was maybe it was cloudy that night and they couldn't find their way back. But I knew deep down that wasn't what happened, that something was wrong.
All three men were experienced ATV riders, and two of them had ridden in the local backwoods many times before. Fearing foul play, friends and family began searching. A few hours later, a local resident stopped 5 miles from the Mason home to check a bad tire. He saw three ATVs covered with blood in a trash dump at the bottom of a bluff.
We received a call on July the 10th that a motorist had found some three-wheelers over the bluff on Roberts Camp Road. The dispatcher requested for us to respond to that area. They at this time informed us that three men from Signal Mountain had left a day earlier going on a ride and had never returned home.
As police retrieved the ATVs, a Signal Mountain resident told them he had heard gunshots the night before, the same night the men had disappeared.
I heard three shots, it might have been four. I told him, I said, damn, if I ain't poaching deer awful early out here, it ain't even cold weather yet.
It's one of the neighbors there, Mr. Joe Skinner, stated that told us where he had been and that he heard shots, and he was sure from his experience that they came from a particular place that he called the gate, but we had never been back in this particular area. And, of course, this is where we wanted to look, is where the shots were heard.
The next morning, police searched the area where the shots had been fired. They found ATV tire tracks. Nothing else seemed out of the ordinary until they approached the gate, an area posted with no trespassing signs.
And as we came to that section, Roy had noticed a green fly had landed on it.
Here, Larry, tell him to look close. There's a green fly on my wrist. There has to be something around here.
Sure. Y'all need to look close in this area here now.
And he made comment, this green fly is in this area, we need to look because they're usually after decaying flesh.
A short distance away, just off the road, they discovered a spot of blood.
Hey, come here, look at this.
At this time, we began searching more around the area. We found a section that appeared that something had been drugged through the woods, through the grass. We searching through that area, and we did find a pool of blood. And after finding this, we roped the area off and advised at the command post that we think we had found the crime scene.
Because police found brain tissue and bone fragments at the scene, they were certain that the three men had been killed. However, no bodies were found. Two days later, at a dump site 11 miles from the crime scene, the bodies of Kenneth Griffith, Earl Smock, and Richard Mason were discovered. All three men had been killed by shotgun blasts. Police tried to make sense of the evidence, which was now scattered over a large area. The three men left from the Mason home, which is located here. The murder site was here, 3 miles to the north at the gate. The three ATVs were discovered here by Roberts Mill Road. The bodies were dumped here by Suck Creek Road, 11 miles from the crime scene. Based on the physical evidence, police have reconstructed the crime.
It appears that the three men were riding the dirt road. They came to the area of the fence. At that time, they were surprised by someone. And it appeared that Kenneth Griffith was apparently the first one that was shot. And he was shot in the left side of the head and apparently killed him instantly. Further indications are that Richard Mason was the second man that was shot. He had one shot to the chest area. Earl Smock was shot directly into the right shoulder. It appeared that he got off of his three-wheeler and attempted to get away. The second shot went into the side, through the heart, and that was a fatal wound. 16 years in the business, it's my opinion that this is one of the most brutal, uncalled for murders ever.
Police believe that after the murders, the killer carefully covered up the evidence. Then, with the help of at least one accomplice, he began his grim journey to dispose of the vehicles and the bodies. An eyewitness told police that he saw two men in a pickup truck on Roberts Mill Road the same night the victims disappeared. In the back of the truck were three ATVs. At the same time the pickup was spotted, another eyewitness reported seeing a woman frantically trying to stop traffic near Roberts Mill Road.
You can't get through, there's an accident.
Her light-colored Chevrolet was blocking the road, just a quarter mile from the bluff where the ATVs were dropped. After the killer and his accomplice dumped the ATVs, police speculate that they returned to the crime scene to retrieve the three bodies. They then drove 11 miles to the Suck Creek Road dump site.
It's obvious that whoever put the bodies there, they wanted the bodies to be found. They wanted them to be found sooner than what they were in order to keep the actual crime scene from ever being found. And had they been found on a Monday instead of on Wednesday, then the actual crime scene at the fence would have never been found.
Police are convinced that the killer is a local resident. The murderer and his accomplices appear to have a detailed and intimate knowledge of the back roads on Signal Mountain. They also knew the ideal locations to dump the ATVs and the bodies. Like the authorities, local residents are worried that the killer is part of their small community.
The people in the area are afraid to come forward, not fear of it happening again in that area, but fear that who was involved in it, if they say anything, will get them.
Every mystery, there is someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone was watching. Perhaps it's you.